May it please the court. I am not going to reiterate everything that Ms. Reeves just said. I would like to follow up on a couple of things and then talk about how this case has a slight different nuance. First of all, in answer to Judge Draper's question, I think this case actually offers a very good example of when you can combine body as a whole. In Mr. Salvicchio's case, we have an instance where he has two hernias. He had them at different times, one in 1999, one in 2005. Settled with the employer, one for 3.5%, one for 4%. That's a perfect example. I believe at the time of Mr. Salvicchio's last injury, his body as a whole related to hernias was 7.5%. That's a great example of when you can add body as a whole things together. That makes sense, I think, under SHIP, what they're talking about there. The same is true if you have three back injuries at the same level, very close back, you know, at the same area of your back. You had them at three different times. Those can be added together to determine what your body as a whole injury was at the time of your last injury, which is what you're looking at.
Well, who does that? Does the commission do it? Does the ALJ do it? Or do we need a medical expert to testify to that?
Personally, I don't think if you have exact injuries to the exact same part of the body, which we can tell from medical records many times, we all become doctors when you play in the workers' compensation field for the most part, but I don't think you need a doctor's expert opinion on that. I think when you're getting into the areas that Ms. Reeves was talking to you more about, like how diabetes and hypertension may interact and that that's truly an overall body as a whole systems type injury that plays together and should be considered as a body as a whole, then I think you do need expert opinion. But I think if it's exactly the same body part on the same body part, such as we have with Mr. Salvicchio with his ventral hernias, I don't think you need expert opinion on that. That's how I see it. The other thing I wanted to talk about here is, with Ms. Reeves, I agree that the Eastern District got it right in this case. We have an Eastern District case here. Ms. Reeves' case was a Western District. I really think the Eastern District did a very nice job of setting forth how they looked at everything and how they analyzed it. Basically, the commission got two things wrong. The first is the fact that they said you only use the 15% threshold to a major extremity if that's the only thing you have preexisting. I don't know how they got there. The Eastern District said, no, that's not right. And they said if you have anything other than just one major extremity, you go to this 50 weeks. The commission is incorrect on that. The Eastern District pointed that out, why that's not true, that we're looking at each individual thing and you compare it to the applicable disability. The second thing is that the commission got wrong was when they decided if we are looking at the 50 weeks, we're going to convert everything to weeks and add it together, even major extremity things, et cetera. That's where we get into a different nuance with this case, because we actually have an extremity injury that meets the 15%, but the question is it a major extremity? So if you get past that the commission was incorrect in how they did it, and you decide, yes, we have to look at each disability individually, what this court is going to have to decide is whether or not the small finger, at the proximal joint, which is right here where your small finger meets your palm, which is defined by statute as 22 weeks, is a major extremity. Mr. Salvicchio has a 50% disability to his small finger at the proximal 22-week joint right here. Actually settled that for 59% with his employer, but the commission decided it was only 50%. I'm not really sure how they did that, but they did, and that I got a little bit confused about that. If you get confused, that's what happened. The question is, if we're looking at each individual disability, is 50 weeks at this level, does it meet thresholds? I would submit to you it does not. The Court of Appeals in this case cited Motton, where we're talking about the major extremities issue and what is an extremity. It talks about it's off of your body. There's lots of different language. I would just say very simply, if this is a major extremity, what's a minor extremity?
Was there any assistance for us in the case law?
There is no assistance for you in whether or not fingers and toes equal major extremity. The only case law we have on that is the Palozzo case out of the Eastern District, which is cited in the Eastern District opinion on this, which tells us that the 110-week level, which is kind of a strange level, I won't put my foot up here for you to see, but if you could think right behind your toes, like kind of at the top of your foot, catching all of your toes, that's a 110-week level. Each toe has its own rating, but then you get back to just behind the toes, it's 110. You get to your ankle, you got 150. You get up a little higher, it's 155.
There's no definition?
No definition. Case law does tell us that the 110-week level, which covers all of the toes, equals a major extremity. Nothing on fingers and toes.
Based on the number of weeks? Based on what, weeks?
I don't know for sure how they decided. They decided that all of your toes together, I guess, that the 110-week level, in their opinion, was a major extremity. That's what the case law holds. That's what we follow.
Of course, we're looking at percentages here.
Well, you're looking at whether or not something's a major extremity. So you decide if something's a major extremity, then you look at the percentages, and is it 15%? So the court in Palozzo decided that the 110-week level is a major extremity. So if you have something 15% or more at the 110-week level, you meet the threshold.
Are there other cases that have allowed recovery for injury by the second injury fund for injuries to fingers or toes without discussing whether it's a major extremity?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I can tell you what we do and what the ALJ pointed out and what I think is what makes sense is that we would hold that if you have a finger injury, you have different levels. Each of your finger joints has a percentage or number of weeks assigned. The nose all end right where your fingers meet your palm. Then you go all the way down to 175 for your wrist. And I certainly believe you can have enough injuries to your fingers that it should equal 15% of your extremity, which is, I believe, a hand is a major extremity, and that's well established. So what we say is if your finger injuries equal 26.25 weeks, which is 15% of your hand, then you've met 15% of a major extremity, but your extremity is not your finger, it's your hand, and that you would qualify. That's what Judge Winman pointed out in her decision when she was the ALJ on this case, and she said because it's only 22 weeks, it doesn't meet 15% of the closest major extremity, which would be the hand, therefore I'm not allowing it. Now, of course, the commission doesn't have any discussion about whether or not this small finger is a major extremity because they said we're going to convert everything to weeks and add it all together. They threw that 22 weeks in to see if it met the 50 weeks, which, of course, I believe is incorrect. But this would be the nuance to this case that needs to be considered. And it will be, as far as I'm aware, a case of first impression as to, again, if fingers and toes, obviously I'm not dealing with the toe, but you could extrapolate that the answer to your fingers would probably be similar to your toes, is a major extremity. And again, I would submit it's not. If we're giving strict construction and meaning to every word, I'm not sure what meaning major would have if indeed your small finger is going to be a major extremity. Again, what would be minor? So that would be my point on that. I think
it may depend on the size of your ears or your nose. I don't know.
Those are not extremities. those would be body as a whole injuries, Judge. But I do think, too, and I won't belabor the point, I do really like the analogy that the court in this case used, the footnote, I think it's footnote 4, back to the whole argument here on whether or not once we exclude things out of meeting the threshold that we suddenly bring them back in. The analogy is that you have an amusement park ride that only allows kids who are 48 inches tall. And so you look at everyone who's under 48, you say, no, you can't go. But then you see that they have someone with them that's 52. And you say, oh, well, if you're going with a 52-inch rider, then all of you get to go. And that's basically what the commission is saying here, because they're saying if you have any one disability that meets the threshold, or if adding them all together you meet the threshold, you meet that definition, then you can ride the ride or you get some fund liability. I would submit to you that the commission was incorrect in how they did this. Mr. Salisbury mentioned, you know, the reasoning of the commission and how he thought that I think Judge Breckenridge asked him a very direct question on, is this different than what they've done? There's no other answer to the yes. This is completely different than what they've done. We've cited in our briefs two cases from August where if you were to follow the logic that the commission issued on these cases in December 8th of 11, where they said, well, we're going to add everything together. We've got two cases cited in our briefs. Steve Penrod and George Moore were in August. Had they followed that logic, those people would have gotten benefits, and they didn't. And the case books are full of other cases. Suarez, Hudson, if you look at the Witte brief, there's a footnote there where they've talked a lot about other cases, other court of appeals cases, where injuries that did not meet the statutory thresholds have been excluded. The reasoning by the commission I do not think is clear. I think that they were a bit arrogant in how they basically said that the ALJ's opinions were not based on law or statute, when clearly I believe the ALJ's opinions were based on what's been done for the last 18 years. And that the ALJ's opinions here on particular Mr. Salvicchio's case should be affirmed. The commission should be overturned. Thank you.
Mr. May it please the court, I did not like the footnote in the Eastern District's opinion, and there are several things that I think are worth pointing out. In each of the cases that were scheduled here in front of you today, the Court of Appeals, both Eastern and Western District, added a word. They added the word each. And each does not show up in 287.220.1. Specifically in these decisions, they say each and every pre-existing disability must reach threshold independently.
Well, they said the use of the word A, it was intended to mean each.
Well, except if you actually, there are headings in each of their decisions that say each pre-existing, that word doesn't show up. And if you read the SHIP decision, that's the complete opposite finding of SHIP. And what the Court of Appeals, at least in my case, and I think it's similar in each of these cases before you this morning, they're really trying to narrow what SHIP says. The Court of Appeals says, well, no, this really only applies in limited circumstances to one major extremity. And that is not what SHIP says. SHIP was a unanimous decision in 2003 where Judge Gartner said, Second Injury Fund, you have provided us no authority to say each and every pre-existing disability on its own must meet threshold. They made that argument in the SHIP case, and the court rejected their argument. And I won't belabor the point because I think prior counsel read that section where SHIP completely contemplated a situation where you would have body as a whole injuries. And I think my opposing counsel just mentioned situations where it would be appropriate to add body as a whole injuries. And I'll give you an example. Hypothetical, you could have somebody who's in a heavy labor position where he would have a 10% back, an 11% back, a 9% back pre-existing. And then maybe his primary injury would be a neck herniation. Walking in the door, that individual has 120 weeks of pre-existing disability to the low back. That would be a perfect example of where I believe the intention of the statute would be to compensate that person. And I think my opposing counsel just said the same thing, that would be appropriate to consider. Well, that's different than what the Court of Appeals is saying in the Salvicio case. They're saying, well, no, if each of those don't independently meet threshold, the person is foreclosed from recovery. Well, that makes no sense. In my case, my client's pre-existing injuries, he had a severed tendon for which he settled as a pro se claimant. His finger is permanently bent. He can't physically cause it to do anything other than this. So when he's working, it gets caught up on things. He has to relearn how to do that. He settled as a pro se claimant, two hernias, which resulted in an abdominal reconstruction. He has scar from here to here. He had to relearn how to move material at work with levers so he wouldn't put stress on his abdominal wall. In my case, the commission said, well, you know, those pre-existing injuries, those certainly qualify as hindrances or obstacles to employment. That's the difference between my case and the Cardwell case, which was already talked about this morning. Cardwell, all of those smaller pre-existing disabilities, none of them were found to be hindrances or obstacles to employment. And if you look at the statute, 220.1 says the very first inquiry is it a hindrance or obstacle? And once you meet hindrance or obstacle, then you discuss the thresholds. And if you meet the thresholds, I think it's the fourth sentence, says you must consider all disability that existed at the time of the injury. That's exactly the way the commission decided the Salvicio case. And I believe that was the correct way to decide the Salvicio case. If we go back to SHIP, as I mentioned, SHIP is a 2003 decision, unanimous decision, and it adopted the commission's award. We all know that the Workers' Compensation Act was revamped, completely redone in 2005. The legislature did not make any changes to 287.220.1, even though the SHIP decision was there. And I think SHIP contemplated something much bigger than just one major extremity.
What answer the question, if a finger is a major extremity, what's a minor extremity?
I don't know how to answer that, but
because
I don't think...
If one interprets a finger as a major extremity, are we not giving any effect to the word major?
Well, that wouldn't be my... I'm sorry to not give you a more direct answer. That wouldn't be my interpretation of the Salvicio case, that the finger was a major extremity. Because I think the way that the commission calculated disability for my client was he met threshold. Everything was a hindrance or obstacle, so that first provision was met. But then he met threshold, and he met threshold on the diabetes, which isn't even discussed in the second injury fund's brief. He met his 50-week minimum threshold because he had a longstanding history of uncontrolled diabetes. So once he met that threshold, then the commission added on that fourth sentence, considering all disability that existed at the time. He had his 50 weeks for his diabetes, and he had the 7.5% from the two hernias, and then they added in the weeks for the finger, which is a slightly different interpretation than what Judge Pfeiffer did in his dissent in Mr. Salisbury's case. But again, I think SHIP contemplates when you have injuries at all different levels, there are going to be situations where it's appropriate to consider all those together and, in essence, stack all of those disabilities, which is what the commission did in my case.
And opposing counsel argued that you can't look at that fourth sentence out of the context of the third, and that once you've narrowed it down to just injuries that meet the 50 weeks or 15%, you can't go back and pick up prior injuries. It means all compensable injuries, all.
Well, I would say it a different way. I don't think you can ignore the fourth sentence. I don't think the inquiry stops with the third sentence. And I think that's kind of what Judge Pfeiffer was pointing out. I believe that if the plain language of the statute, it doesn't say each, it says hindrance or obstacle, did you meet the thresholds, and it's thresholds for both the pre-existing and the primary injury, and if you meet those triggering mechanisms, then you consider all disability. And again, in my client's case, all of his pre-existing disabilities were considered to be a hindrance or obstacle. If it's a hindrance or obstacle, by definition, it's not de minimis. The definition of de minimis is trivial, trifling, of no importance.
Except doesn't the legislature have the right to decide what's a minimum amount of injury to be able to recover for under the second injury fund?
I think
so. They could define de minimis as more broadly if.
Well, I think they certainly could, and I don't think that they have, and they certainly...
But they added in something more than just a hindrance or obstacle. They had that second. They added in that second requirement, so they did require something more.
In 93, yeah. That's true. But following the SHIP decision, there were no changes made to the statute in 2005. Again, I don't think that the Court of Appeals and any of the decisions in front of you today really went in depth with respect to legislative intent. And I think that the commission, in all of our decisions, laid out the legislative history and intent fairly clearly. Those were really the points I wanted to make. If there are any other questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Did the claimant in this case meet the threshold based upon the diabetes?
Yes, and we have not appealed that. The commission found that it was 12.5% to the body as a whole and awarded benefits to that. We didn't appeal that issue. So Mr. Salvicchio would be entitled to benefits for the combination between his 50 weeks of disability for his diabetes and his last injury.
Then why do they say all injuries if you're not supposed to look back and include all the injuries?
as the Court of Appeals has explained, the two sentences that we're talking about, which are actually the third and fourth sentence of that statute, the third sentence is the qualifying round. What are we going to look at here? I'm not sure where Ms. Ortuarte gets her definition that de minimis, if you are a hindrance or obstacle, if
it's a hindrance or obstacle. But it doesn't say any injuries that met the minimum compensable amount are then added together. It says all injuries.
I think how that looks at, or why it says that, is because you may very well have more than one injury that meets the thresholds.
But it doesn't say that either, right?
It doesn't. It says all disabilities. I can't lie with what the sentence says.
So how do we, are you asking us to add, she's saying you're asking us to add in words that it's all injuries that meet the threshold. Why aren't you doing that?
I think I'm not, because if you read the Eastern District Court of Appeals, they very clearly set this forth. You can't read it. You can't read the fourth sentence without having read the third.
She's given meaning to both. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but she's saying you have to meet the threshold. If you do, then they want everything to be compensable. That gives meaning to both. Why is it the wrong meaning?
I don't think it does give meaning to both, because why go through sentence three at all if you are going to then bring everything back in sentence four?
So that you have a minimum threshold injury.
I don't believe that that's what we're talking about here. And you're reading, I think to get there you have to read it with a hyper-technical language. All the courts of appeals have pointed out when you read this in context that it makes no sense to cull out the de minimis injuries and then pull them back in. Because if you follow that rationale, you're pulling everything in, even things that aren't a hindrance or obstacle. So you'd be pulling in a 1% to your whatever, your toe, your foot. I mean, if you say you just have to have one thing and you've met the thresholds, then we're going to pull everything in. Talk about pulling in de minimis injuries. I can't even imagine what you would be doing. You would no longer be looking at things that are anywhere near the thresholds. If you said all disabilities, that I just don't think that's what was intended at all. And again, pointing out to, it certainly is not what has been done either. I would point that it would be a complete change from how we've been doing this, how the courts of appeals have done it, what has been held in the past. And I would say that it would not be a good change. It would not follow what the intent of the meaning was. You would no longer call out anything if you did that. Ms. Ortuarte argues that Cardwell is different, and that the only reason those things were taken out in Cardwell was because they weren't a hindrance or obstacle. I would say that's not true. If you look, it says here the commission determined the percentages of permanent partial disability, that they did not meet the percentages of permanent partial disability. It's not solely based upon whether or not they were hindrance or obstacle. I'm out of time. So I would just say that the commission was incorrect in what they did. It's not based in law or statute, and I would ask you to reverse the commission's decision.
Thank you very much.